fascinating. Gadgets, gizmos, and gear-based technologies.
Welcome to FGGBT. Now, this is the show that takes your favorite fictional science and technology, and we make it a reality. We are the Brain Trust. I am the analytical mastermind, Daniel J. Glenn. With me, the physics phenom, Dr. Michael Denning.
Dan, great to be here. You know, you surprised us with this choice, and I am so glad you did, because I rediscovered my joy of what I'm going to call disaster films. Lots of people dying and lots of havoc. It was fun.
I'll tell you, I surprised myself, Denning. I didn't think I would ever pick a movie about a gigantic shark killing a bunch of people. But here we are. We're all growing and we're all learning. Right. And there's one man who I think has stopped learning because he knows it all, and that is our enigmatic engineer, Ben Siebser. Ben, how are you doing up there and the safety of the Brain Station?
Well, Dan, you can never learn enough. And that's why this week I've been studying the extinct sea creatures. And I've come to the conclusion that our modern day sea predators are just they're not big enough. There's no more mosasaurs, no more plesiosaurs. And our sharks, well, they're just embarrassingly small these days.
Well, that is the wimpification of our society, I guess, is what's going on here. And it's extending to our sharks. And I, for one, am completely happy about it, Ben, because as everyone knows, sharks are one of my greatest fears. But you bring up something interesting here, Den. And, you know, I was going to say that this movie, we're going to talk about Meg and Meg 2, The Trench. And by default, the megalodon and all the things that can live at the bottom of the ocean. But before we do that, I have to say, I didn't watch this movie for my own reasons. But when I did, it's surprisingly clever. It's got an interesting premise. They pull it off. It's an extraordinarily mediocre, what I was going to call an action slash horror slash sci-fi movie, Denning. I think you might have nailed it as a disaster movie. I didn't consider it that. But now that you mention it, I think you're right.
Well, yeah, you know, it just reminded me of a couple of things. So first of all, I really enjoyed as a kid Poseidon Adventure. I think that's what mm-hmm. it was called, and Tower yep. Inferno. I actually saw them in a drive-in. So, you know, ooh. Really big screen. Yeah, kind of old school there. I don't know if any of our viewers or listeners remember what those are.
They came back during, 2020, 2021.
That's
very
true.
Popular.
Mm-hmm. Very popular. But what I think the key thing about it is the number of apparently main characters that die. Right. When I think of the modern action adventure movie, very few people die. Right. I mean, even in the Marvel universe, except when he snaps his fingers. Mm-hmm. Right. Like, you have these huge battles, lots of buildings destroyed, but not many people. And in this movie, right, like Meg 2, The Trench, I forgot that all those people in the submarine, except the four key that you need, the big actors, were subject to death, and they all died. I hate to say this publicly. It was kind of cool. Like, oh yes, your thing's cracking. Oh yep, that's the way it works. You die. Sorry.
Yeah.
Well, and you can't forget all the terrorized swimmers.
Oh yeah,
lots of holiday goers didn't make it home.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting because it is, you know, a megalodon, let's say a giant shark, you know, I'm not going to commit to megalodon here, guys, and I don't think you are either, but a giant shark, we can all agree that's at least a giant shark.
Definitely a big shark.
You're right. It does terrorize a lot of people. It's a natural phenomenon. It exists outside, you know, it is, you know, we're going to talk how it exists, but it exists through the natural course of nature and evolution. So, I mean, what's the difference between that or a volcano or an asteroid hitting the Earth or, you know, any other disaster you could think of, Denning?
No, I'm totally with you, Dan. And as Ben said, it's just swimming around scooping up people.
Right.
Like, this is pretty brutal. And I think that's the thing I like about disaster movies. Mm-hmm. They commit to this. Now, I need to ask you a technical film question, Dan. Okay. I was thinking about this, and I feel like a difference between a disaster film and a horror movie, right? Mm. There is moments of tension in a disaster film, but it's not the same type of scaring one, right? First of all, the jump scares, I mean, I know they play scary music in horror movies, but you know when the shark is coming, right? Like, the music tells you. But also, I feel like in a horror film, there's the potential that everyone dies. in a disaster film, you know there's a few key people that are going to survive. Like, you do something about the disaster by the end. In the horror film, I feel like it's 50-50 what happens at the end to all the people. Am I wrong there, Dan? Or I mean, I just have to ask you this as the master of film and television.
I love questions like this because I get to pretend that I'm an expert instead of talking about science, which I know almost nothing about. And I have to say, Denon, you know, you give me props when I bring up interesting things about foam or any sort of science you've taught me. And I feel like you've now, you know, the master has taught the student to become the master, something like that. This is a very Karate Kid of what's going on here.
Right.
So here's what I would say, Denon. This is, you bring up an interesting point. And I'm thinking about it now. The difference between a disaster movie and a horror movie, I think it's not who survives. I think it's it's a horror movie is like one-on-one. It's Michael Myers versus who they're going after. It's, you know, Jason versus whomever. Freddy's going after one person's dreams. And in a disaster movie, everybody's coming together to fight off the threat. And I think by that logic, Denon, you've just completely rewired my brain here. You could almost argue that zombie movies are horror movies, but they're also a disaster. Most of them are disaster movies by that definition that I literally just created 3 seconds ago.
I love it, Dan. I think you're going to go down as famous for this new new discovery.
I hope so. Well, you know, and this was hard for me, guys, because you know my fear of sharks and giant ones.
Oh,
nonetheless,
yeah.
this was really something. So let's start where the movie does. And that's at the Mariana Trench, which is this, basically, it's the Grand Canyon under the ocean. It's this gigantic, deep crevice in the middle of the I think it's Pacific Ocean, correct me if I'm wrong, Pacific Ocean. Lots of crazy stuff down there. It's very deep, miles deep. I think the deepest part is about 35 and some change, almost 36,000 feet deep. It's about 6.8 miles. And you guys will love this, coming off our recent film discussion from 3 seconds ago. James Cameron in 2012 set a record for going down 35,787 feet to explore this trench. It's pretty crazy. Of course, James Cameron would have done it. But this is a deep part of the ocean, guys, is what I'm saying.
Oh, very deep. And Dan, you may be scared of sharks. I don't know. I think my newfound discovery of claustrophobia in my life probably makes it such that I'm never going down there, because the only way to go down there is in small things. Mm-hmm. And then there's just a lot of pressure, let's just say, pun intended, while you're down there.
Yeah.
That I enjoyed watching it in the safety of my living room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no cruise ships going down to the trench.
No.
Not tourists.
Yeah, it goes back to the, I think it's back to the horror versus disaster. And I think it's probably more man versus world when you're talking about the Mariana Trench. So I guess that's the disaster film going down there.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it's crazy because things are very different down there. You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting, and we'll kind of get to this, is that, you know, Ben, you and I were discussing squids and the giant squid, which is a very elusive creature. You know, we didn't even know it existed until very recently because it lives in the deepest parts of the ocean, I was told. I went to the Shedd Aquarium when I was a kid in Chicago, and when you walk in, they have a stuffed, I don't know if it's stuffed, might even be plastic, I don't know, but it's a gigantic giant squid. I guess maybe it's an average-sized giant squid. None of this is important. What's important is that you see a model of it on the ceiling, and they're huge.
Yeah.
But the deepest part of the ocean that they're talking about, and this is my point, is 1,000 feet deep, 2,000 feet deep. I just told you the Mariana Trench is 36,000 feet deep. So all of the activity in the ocean, or most of it, exists in a relatively small section of the world down there.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's definitely true. And there's some simple physics for that, Dan, besides the pressure.
Okay.
Right? The pressure is tough. You do want, well, not everybody, but you would prefer some light or some things that had light that can get down to you.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Most things in life do require oxygen, particularly the big stuff. And if you're not going to have light and plants to make it yourself, you need some circulation. Mm-hmm. So you need the oxygen circulating around. And, you know, currents and all of that tend to be confined in layers. That's just some hydrodynamics and fluids. There is some exchange with the super deep ocean, but I don't think it's kind of regular enough and useful enough for life. And so you do get this interesting phenomena of things, relatively speaking, being near the surface from just that physics side of things.
And it really just comes down to, you know, if you're going to be a big creature like a squid, you need big things to eat too.
Right.
And generally speaking, big things are going to stay at the surface because it's the food web, right? The most plentiful biomass in the ocean is the krill. It's the plankton. It's the stuff that lives on the surface and uses the sun to get its energy. And you're not going to be, you need to be near that part of the food web to have these large animals.
You know, I think there, Ben, you were talking very much like a physicist in one regard. You mentioned big things in biomass, and your example was a lot of krill, which is a lot of little things making one big thing. So I felt very physics-y there. I like that.
That's like the equivalent of nanobots in the ocean in some ways. Right. Right? Like plankton and krill, they're very small, but they are considerable when added together. Yeah. So let's talk about it. But this was interesting to me. You know, that particular section of the ocean is called the Twilight Zone. So I'm already enthralled. But let's go down deeper. You know, this movie takes place at the bottom. It takes place deeper than the bottom of the ocean, which we'll talk about in a second. But we got to set the stage here. We got to talk about the environment that this movie operates in, and that's the deepest parts of the ocean. Going down there, as you mentioned, Denon, there's no light, a lot of pressure. It's very cold. This is not a place you want to be. You know, I would argue that this part of the world is the most inhospitable place that human beings know of outside of a magma ball, let's say, right? It's difficult to live down there. So what happens? Yes, Denon. Were you going to correct that?
I was just going to say nothing. No, I was going to agree with you and say nothing good.
nothing good. So what happens? let's say, Denon, you know, I want you to describe this, Ben, because you're more gruesome in your details. So if you were to take a person, a human being, and transport them down there, you know, unprotected by any sort of technology, what happens to the human body at the depths of the trench?
Yeah, so if you just pop a person into the depths of the ocean where they were just immediately at, like, surface pressure, basically they're going to collapse. Every bit of air inside of you is going to get either squeezed out or collapsed by the pressure of the ocean. So your stomach's going to get collapsed, your intestines are going to get collapsed, your lungs are going to get collapsed, your nose, your mouth, those are going to get filled with water, your ears are going to get filled with water.
Your butt.
And your intestines, so you're just going to get either completely squished and or filled with water, and it's not going to be a fun time.
You know, the interesting thing about that, and there's kind of a cool physics here, is, as Ben correctly pointed out, it's the air that's squishy, right? If you just take the water in you, water is basically incompressible. It will get pressurized. And I think a great visual for this is anyone who's flown in an airplane and drank their water bottle while they're up in the air. As you land, that water bottle gets crushed because what's in it is air, and you're actually going to slightly higher pressure. I mean, it does compress some. But if it stays full of water, nothing happens to it, right? It just stays the same. And now that's just being in your airplane, which still has a pressurized cabin, but not fully pressurized.
Ideally,
and then you come back to the surface. You know, what we're talking about, like the miles that you're going underwater, is just orders of magnitude more pressure than the change in the airplane. And already your water bottle was crushed. So just think of that as your lungs. But if you could be made out of water, Dan, you'd go down and you would just feel a little pressure.
You wouldn't feel much, is what you're saying. You'd feel be normal.
Right. And that's why things like sharks can go down deep, is because they are water. They don't have lungs to get squished. I'm assuming their digestive systems are full of fluid. And they breathe, you know, through their gills. So it's all liquid. And that's why they can survive at these depths, is because there's nothing in them to get squished by the pressure.
That is really interesting, because that explains some of the adaptations, that gigantic creature. We're talking about gigantic sharks living at the bottom of this trench. I mean, they have to have some sort of adaptations to live. You know, they don't carry around a flashlight, but they have other adaptations, right, that allow them to live at this level. But this whole thing about being mostly water, this is interesting because there are creatures on our planet that seem to be, I don't want to say, I think you'd want to say they're 99.9 ad infinitum percent water, right? Like they're very little other. And that includes, you know, octopus, squids, you mentioned, jellyfish are probably in that category as well. So then it raises the question, and you said this, so I'm going to give you full credit, but I'm going to repeat it back to you because I think it's interesting. But how much of your body would need to be made up of water to be considered water from a physics standpoint?
Well, for me, I think you're talking 95 to 100%. Why am I giving you 5%, Dan? Right? The reason is, you know, you can have easy ways for the little bit that's not water to get ejected out of your structures, and you're still basically yourself.
Okay.
I'm happy with a 5% compression. That's my limit as a physicist, right? You know, if you're 5% smaller, that's not so bad. But a key piece of this is that sort of you're ejecting the air versus structurally being destroyed. And so that's why I'm like, you know, if 95% of you in the right geometric shape, you know, is water, you're water. Like a foam, for instance, is like only 1% or 5% water, but with the right structure, it just shrinks into that water when you stick it down deep. So that's the other extreme, and it's really not a foam anymore, Dan, so then I would say you're destroyed. So we can go to the other extreme. 5% water is not good enough. 95%, I'm okay.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, I remember reading this article about Taco Bell meat and that it was 47% beef. And I wondered, how in the world is that possible? And again, I wonder, how could you be 95% water and be alive? These are all questions that my brain wrestles with as we work through this.
I mean, one thing to think about is there are fish that have things called swim bladders, which are structures designed to hold air at depth, so that the fish can change their depth, their buoyancy, so that they can swim up and down without fighting against whether or not they should be floating or sinking where they're at. And so there are fish that have these structures, like cod, for example, that can both live very deep and live relatively higher up in the water column. This is an adaptation that they've created to have this section of air that isn't a problem.
I love learning about all these little these evolutionary adaptations that allow an animal to do the seemingly impossible. You know, and that's kind of what we see here. Living at this depth is seemingly impossible. What else is seemingly impossible, but also a clever twist in this movie, is how do we get... We're trying to get to the megalodon here, guys. Just like evolution is trying to get there. We're trying to get there. But we got to do it in steps. And the next step is in this movie at the bottom of the deepest part of the ocean. What they've discovered is a layer of hydrogen sulfide that looks like the bottom of the ocean, but in fact, you can go through this hydrogen sulfide layer and enter into an entirely new world that has been isolated completely from the rest of the ocean. This is really interesting, and I think, you know, as far as crazy ideas and conceits for movies go, this one kind of, you know, pun intended, holds water.
Oh, it's way better than Journey to the Center of the Earth, Dan.
Kind of is. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Right, way better. Definitely. And you know, we even though we explained that, this is easier to explain. Now, what I like about it, though, I wonder, you know, first of all, it's so deep. It's completely reasonable. We haven't been super careful. I kind of like the idea, past people thought here's the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, that is good. And then you go through it and you actually find life. And I think the real big question for me when I saw that the first time was, okay, where are they getting their oxygen? right? Because a lot of the creatures look very familiar to us in this. So I think on the two hands, I think you're totally right. This is way more reasonable than lots of other scenarios. But I do still like the question, where's the oxygen? Because as we discussed, even though you're not breathing big chunks of air, fish are getting oxygen out of the water, but that oxygen came from mixing with stuff at the surface. So you got to kind of think that through. But other than that, I think you're pretty good down there.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this before, how there's layers of the ocean and places where there isn't a lot of mixing. And you can definitely imagine, especially in a trench where there's potentially not a lot of sideways currents going across, you can very easily imagine a layer forming that isn't getting disturbed to create such an action. You know, we see this all the time in caves and other stuff where you have these very distinct layers of in the water column that don't mix like at all. And so it's perfectly reasonable that this kind of an environment or this kind of an area could form. Whether or not it's a livable environment is debatable, as Dr. Dennett talked about.
Right. Well, let's talk about this phenomenon really quickly before we talk about the feasibility of living down there. Because I think because there's one point of egress, right? There is just the top of the trench. And if you coat that, you know, we have lots of sealants in our world, you know, where you can put some kind of expanding foam, Dennett, you know, we're going to mention it twice.
Yes.
And it seals all the points of entry and exit. This is kind of doing that naturally. You know, this is the equivalent of, you know, a landmass suddenly separating and becoming an island. And then millions of years later, the animals that were isolated on that island have different, you know, that's how the dodo became extinct, because it didn't need to fear anything and it didn't need to fly. And then humans came by, you know. That's the Cliff Notes drunk history version, but I think it's relatively accurate. But this is a really cool point, because I was looking at hydrogen sulfide. They say it's a freezing layer, but if I understand the math correctly, and the pressure might be different at those levels, but at STP, standard temperature and pressure, it is a liquid. Hydrogen sulfide is a liquid at negative 60 degrees Celsius, between negative 60 and negative 85 degrees Celsius. That's pretty cold, and that is, I think, just a significant enough deterrent to keep things from going up and to keep things from going down, besides humans, of course.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in the movie they do talk about it from the temperature point of view, Dan. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it more just from the nature of the chemical and the structure, right? These are creatures who are very sensitive to their surrounding.
Sure.
Right? They need a particular, and they're going to be, it's sort of like if you can't breathe air, you know where the edge of the water is, right? If you can't
or the
breathe
edge of the
hydrogen
atmosphere.
Sulfide. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I feel like this is more, less a temperature barrier, though that can be part of it, but much more this kind of physical chemical barrier, like the foam example you gave. I do think there's a possibility, right? If you think about it, these creatures are probably thriving there because of extra warmth from volcanic activity.
Yes.
And then the cold can be a thing, but not just the hydrogen sulfide cold. That's kind of an insulating layer. The rest of the ocean's just as cold, right? They just don't want to go into the cold in general. Right.
I see. Yeah.
So I think there's two effects going on. I think the temperature is part of it, but I think the bigger one is they just can't breathe hydrogen sulfide.
Well, I would say, one thing here, Ben, because I want to make this real for our listeners. This is kind of what you're saying, then, is this the equivalent of human beings love a nice warm bath. Ice baths have become very popular and supposedly, you know, can kind of hold off inflammation and keep your body feeling pretty good, but no one wants to jump into an ice bath, me included, is basically what you're saying. Okay, all right.
Yes.
I just want to make sure I understand it correctly. Yeah. Anyway,
no, sorry, you do. Well, you do.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so clearly nothing living down there is part of a polar bear club, I think is what we're
an elite athlete, right,
here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it makes, I think that actually the breathing is also interesting. We don't really see how thick this layer is.
Right.
But if it's reasonably thick, I mean, hydrogen sulfide is not something you want to breathe either. So, like, it's also quite reasonable to think that anything that tries to ascend through this at, say, a swimming pace will just choke on it and die.
Well, I think there's two things here. Number one, it smells like farts, which is already a deterrent. You know?
Right.
Number two, I think it's toxic as well. It's not great for you to ingest, whether you are using your gills or your lungs.
If it's an actual layer, that would imply it is a high percentage in that zone is just hydrogen sulfide, and that is not a safe environment for any living creature.
No, definitely not. But what it does, you know, we can all agree that it isolates this section, and I think the vents, then it's a great point, keep it nice and warm for all the animals to exist down there. So what we find in this movie is this pristine world where creatures that either existed long ago are now living, or there is additional evolution, maybe convergent evolution down there, where things, just like on islands, just like across the world, things are evolving along the same tracks in parallel without having any relationship to each other. This is a pretty interesting idea because, you know, we do see pockets on our planet, interesting pockets of creatures where they exist in one specific location and nowhere else. The Venus flytrap is my favorite example. It only exists, I think, in a 75 square mile area, not radius, but an area in South Carolina, one of the Carolinas. I think it's South Carolina. This is super interesting and very possible. This is not implausible, is what I'm trying to say.
There's lots of these micro environments all over the planet. You know, you think about, say, Madagascar. Animals that live on Madagascar are completely different. A lot of them are completely different than what lives everywhere else on the planet. Or you think about these Pacific islands. There's all sorts of creatures on these islands that are completely different than what live elsewhere. Or another great example, right? Darwin going to the Galapagos Islands, right? Yeah. There's creatures on the Galapagos Island that are totally unique to those islands. And they show that when you're on these isolated areas, you get very different evolution and different things can happen there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the real trick for this is how does and what does get trapped as this layer forms.
Yeah.
Because as we discussed at the beginning, Dan, this is very, very deep, right? Mm-hmm. So there's very little, I think, that would have been down there to begin with to seed the area. But once you have that, your point of, well, what's it going to do later? Because we're assuming this formed millions of years ago based on the movie, right? That's a lot of time for things to change and evolve potentially or be stuck, right? Because there's not a lot of variety. You're already in your niche and you're happy and you don't evolve, right? So it's an interesting question there of, you know, what are you going to do? Maybe you're already optimized and you just keep having children and they're the same. And anything that's a mutation is by definition less optimal and dies out.
Yeah. Right. It's also possible to think that maybe this layer started out a lot shallower. And as it formed, it sank, trapping shallow creatures lower and lower.
I like that. I like that, Ben.
As it, you know, shrunk this environment from a shallows environment to a deep environment. And now you have these creatures that originally started in the shallows that are stuck now in the depths.
So it's kind of like a fence, like a moving electric fence that just crammed everything down and
that lowered over tens of millions of
years. And funneled them into this small little section of it's possible. Yeah. I mean, that would definitely lend credence to the fact that these are prehistoric creatures that were slowly over time pushed down and unable to get up, and everything above that layer is brand new from an evolutionary standpoint.
Yeah, and generally speaking, shallow creatures, right? Sharks are generally shallow, octopus, squid. They're certainly not Mariana Trench kind of creatures.
No.
So we have to be trapped there. I would say it had to start shallower.
Okay, fair enough.
I really like that solution, Ben. I'm all in with you.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. Dan, I think we're done here. Our work is done. We have solved the whole thing.
We did. I think we did. Well, this brings up an interesting point, right? Because I want to just mention a couple of things here, because what we're going to talk about as we spend 30 minutes talking about what we're going to talk about, we're going to get to the Megalodon. But this is interesting because there are what we've previously classified as extinct, we have found them later on. There are lots of animals we believe that disappeared from the Earth, but existed in either small pockets or very deep in the ocean. You know, a couple of great examples, you know, the kangaroo rat of Santa Cruz. This was just discovered recently in the past couple of years. That was last seen in 1947. This one's for you, Denon. The giant river otter in Argentina was last seen in the 80s, recently made a reemergence. Ben, I believe you mentioned the coelacanth. This was last seen, this is much further back, 68 million years ago. And I think one is as recent as 1998. So that's pretty interesting. And of course, the Australian night parrot is another famous one, last seen in 1912, considered extinct. One was found very recently. So this does happen. And this doesn't even include animals that have been reintroduced to the wild, like wolves in Yellowstone and things like that, which raises an interesting question about introducing animals into these types of environments. But what I'm saying is that extinct we think they're extinct. They may not be. So it always raises the possibility that maybe in some remote area of our ocean, these things could exist.
Well, you know, we already have evidence, Dan, that, you know, this happened in lakes with the Loch Ness monster. So the ocean is just that much better, right? That's like
hard proof from what I've seen. I've seen the pictures, Dan. I've seen the
I have
irrefutable.
Too. I will tell you, you know, my childhood, I'm a weird person. We all know that, right? Mm-hmm. I always doubted Bigfoot, but I was a big believer of Loch Ness. That seemed reasonable to me because, and I think, Ben, you will relate to this, because I really wanted dinosaurs to still be alive. Like it was that hope that yes, there is a dinosaur around that I could meet, because, you know, it was my love of the Flintstones. It was my love of dinosaurs, you know, and it just goes to show sometimes hope can, you know, blind you maybe to what's going on.
Well, it makes you open to the possibilities, I would say. And I will also say, as an academic, Denon, there are more academics studying Sasquatch than there are the Loch Ness Monster. I don't know what that says. I interviewed one of them on Fascinating Nouns. I'll put a link to it in the description. But so they're out there, Denon. There, people are out there doing this for sure.
Yeah, but they're looking for the wrong thing. Who cares about a big hairy man? You want a dinosaur, Dan. You want a dinosaur.
More academics studying the Loch Ness Monster. This is a cry for help from Dr. Michael Denon. Yeah. So let's get to it. Let's talk about these extinct creatures. So one of the greatest predators ever to exist in the world was the megalodon. This is a gigantic shark that existed, between 25 and 2.6 million years ago. It ruled the oceans from what I understand. This is what we see in this movie. This is what existed at the bottom of that trench. We've already said that it may be possible. I've seen megalodon jaws. I put my grandmother in them when I took her to natural history museum. She fit comfortably in her little wheelchair. She fit comfortably in the jaws of this thing. That's terrifying to think about. And maybe this is the idea for Jonas and the Whale. You know, I feel like we could fit in the gullet of a gigantic megalodon.
Well, based on the movie Meg 2, about 6 or 8 to maybe 15 people could fit in a gullet. They just kept scooping them up, Dan. I was trying to count, right? Like, it was getting quite large. Yeah. What I think is fascinating, not just about the megalodon, it is the degree to which we, I think, underestimate how big creatures can get.
Yeah.
Because we're in an era of not particularly big creatures. I mean, there is the blue whale out there, but very rarely, I don't know about you guys, I don't think many people except in a museum really see a blue whale or a model of a blue whale. I mean, elephants are big, but they're not huge, right? Like, and that's about as big as we get these days. I mean, a giraffe is tall, but it's kind of skinny and lanky. You know, the size that dinosaurs reached on land and in the water is something that I think is hard for the human brain to comprehend.
Although, to be fair, the blue whale is the biggest animal to have ever, that we know of.
Yeah, but we don't see him a lot, Ben. That's my point.
But it is cool that we exist alongside the largest known animal ever.
Yeah.
The dinosaurs are big, and land mammals are much easier to appreciate. But the blue whales are enormous, enormous creatures.
Well, and I will tell you, you know, there is, when you see the megalodon, this is kind of like Jurassic Water Park, right? I mean, seeing one of these things, you know, it's not man-made, it is nature-made, even though nature and man-made are kind of the same thing, according to Denon's warped logic. But this is basically Jurassic Water Park. But this is an interesting little tidbit I picked up, is that... So you have to work these calculations out, right? So the University of California's Museum of Paleontology did some work on the fossils of megalodon jaws, which is all we have. All we have are their jaws. 2.6 million years ago is the last confirmed megalodon jaw. Human beings appeared 2.5 million years ago. Now, if you have a couple of rounding errors here, guys, which is what we work in because we weren't alive back then, there is a not zero chance, actually a very significant chance, that human beings and megalodons existed at the exact same time. That's a terrifying concept to me. I don't know if you guys find comfort in that or if you find it interesting, given your love of dinosaurs and all things gigantic.
I think there's a good reason that people stayed on the savannas and prairies back then. I'm guessing they didn't go into the somewhat deeper parts of the ocean where the megalodons were probably still around.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question, Dan, because it feels kind of Flintstone-ish to me, right? Like,
okay,
right. We have these sort of false pictures of humans and dinosaurs being around because, you know, that's fun to picture. But we know the land dinosaurs were not around with humans, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. as humans. But I think the sea, you know, who knows? And look, basically sharks are still sharks. They're just a different size. And, you know, mm-hmm. crocodiles are basically still I forget how old they are, but like crocodiles pretty and alligators, old. There are some things that are pretty old. So I think to Ben's point, I think this is just why we don't hear of those water-faring early civilizations, right? It's the savannah in Africa.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is where we sprouted, right? So you sprout in Africa. It's a gigantic continent that is very far from the Pacific Ocean, right? Human beings had to travel quite a bit to get there. And for the longest time, people thought, you know, at the edge of those waters were gigantic sea creatures. Maybe they were right.
Yes,
you know, they may have been correct, because you know, just to give some context here, the megalodon is roughly, I think, three times as large as our current great white. Their teeth are about three times bigger, which is kind of how we're doing the estimations. So between 60 and 80 feet long, I think it's the largest shark on record. That's pretty large, and as you mentioned, Ben, biomass is very important. So a creature that is that large and is able to sustain breeding populations also that large, they got to eat stuff, is what you're saying.
They sure do.
They sure got to eat a lot. And sharks, of all the creatures in the world, probably eat more than most. I mean, these are basically gigantic chainsaws with fins, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're an active predator. Things that swim in general need to eat a lot because you're in the water. You have to keep warm. You need a pretty active metabolism to survive, especially if you're a hunting shark like the megalodons almost certainly were. There's estimates that they were eating over 2,000 to 2,500 pounds of food a day. So that explains the massacre on the swimming area. You know, that's like, you know, if we're talking about like 60-pound children, you know, that's a lot of, you got to eat a lot of little kids at the beach to satisfy that hunger.
But significantly fewer American tourists, if I understand.
Significantly, yeah. Yeah, it's a good thing that, you know, that's why it was not an American beach.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
he would have been like five guys and he'd be fine.
If he ran through the Gulf of Mexico and hit some of those southern states, no offense, I'm just looking at the numbers here. I think you could sustain a breeding population of megalodon in that area.
But from what we can tell from the fossil evidence, these were very powerful. The megalodons may have had the strongest jaws of any animal to ever live.
Wow.
And they were crunching on whales. You know, they would swim up from the depths and just bite a whale. And we see all sorts of damage both in their teeth and in whales from that time period that looked like they got chomped on by pretty big sharks. And odds are it was the megalodons doing that.
Dan, that's a great pressure thing for people to understand is, you know, the biting power of their teeth right, mm-hmm. is just immense compared to anything we've seen right now, and certainly mm-hmm. compared to our own Jaws, right? And so when you look at the disaster movie and you see them like biting through the dock, right, or attacking a sub or a ship, you know, it's funny the stuff that triggers as being silly to our visual because we don't see mm-hmm. that a lot now, but is not necessarily that far off when you think about the extra pressure that they can generate.
Yeah. Well, and the mass too, right? You know, we talk they're three times longer than that shark, but that means they're like 20 times heavier. And so just from mass alone, it's not completely unrealistic. It's certainly realistic that, you know, if they were bashing a pier, you know, some, you know, poorly constructed fishing pier, of course they could break that apart.
Well, it's also interesting because as human beings, right, we have 32 teeth in our head. I don't know if that's counting wisdom teeth or not. My numbers might be off. Might be 34. I don't actually know. I know it's in the 30s. But what's important is that when we bite stuff, I mean, my grandmother just had a tooth fall out of her head, right? She's got most of her own teeth, but I had to get her tooth replaced. The point is, she really now is very careful about what she bites into. That's not mm-hmm. the case with a shark. As a matter of fact, mm-mm. with sharks, when they lose a tooth, they got three or four waiting to pop right back up on a conveyor belt. I mean, talk about the efficiency. You know, you mentioned this one time, Denon, that endpoint of evolution, right?
Right.
Evolution's looking to be the most efficient possible. And having a conveyor belt. I mean, this is before the days of Henry Ford and the assembly line. Nature had already created it in the mouth of a shark long before. So they can be completely indiscriminate about what they bite, be it human, a pier, or a metal submarine.
No, definitely. I think they do a great job of just chewing into things, Dan. I mean, I'm always a little jealous. I mean, as a child, I had this wildlife series of books that for some reason we only got two of and never bought more.
I had three copies. I had three volumes of an encyclopedia when I was a kid, so I know what you're talking about.
So I had cats, and I had, ironically, there was a book dedicated to sharks and you know non bony fish. It was really weird, right?
Okay.
And so I read those books a lot, and it was a close call. You know, the most optimized predator, whether it's the apex cat or the apex shark, right? They're predators in slightly different environments, slightly different ways, right? But they are just killing machines. Everything about them is designed to hunt and kill you.
It'd be tough for the dentists if we were like sharks, you know. But I love this idea. You know, you break a tooth. Mm-hmm. You know, chomping on a whale, mm-hmm. and you don't care because it's gonna fall out in like a month anyways.
Yeah.
It's this amazing adaptation. Now, unfortunately, you spend a lot of energy growing all of these teeth. And so there are advantages to the mammal mode of having just the two sets over your whole lifetime. But, you know, you don't worry about cavities. You don't worry about chips. You know, you just get new teeth.
Yeah, you have to eat a lot of bones. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I know you're afraid of sharks, right?
I'm terrified.
And I know their teeth are probably something you're most afraid of, which is why definitely. I really
appreciate.
I'm having
a hard time talking about this. Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate the gift you gave Ben and I this year, because there's nothing that'll protect you from a shark better than a t-shirt. And particularly a t-shirt that's well-designed, one that threatens the apocalypse. A shark is going to take one look at this t-shirt, Dan, and they're just turning around and leaving me. And if they do try and bite me, right, the material fills in the wounds and stops the bleeding right away. It's like an instant bandage. So I appreciate this, Dan, because, you know, I'm not quite as afraid of sharks as you are, but I love being protected from them. So the anti-shark teeth healing, self-healing wound t-shirt is available for sale, and I recommend everybody get one.
I would just like to say to limit our legal liability, this in no way actually protects you from shark bites, and it will not seal your wounds. That is hyperbolic salesmanship on the part of Dr. Michael Denon. That's just for, but other than that, please pick one of these up. I don't want to discourage you from that point.
But you know what will protect you from shark bites? That's being a cyborg and having metal skin, like you see me here in my t-shirt. You know, if you have metal skin, you know, sharks can bite through whale bones and things like that. But I bet they can't bite through titanium skin. And so that is truly the dream. You know, having the shark chip all of its teeth on your indestructible exoskeleton and then swimming away.
Well, and I think that those are great points. And I will say that what also sharks don't want to eat celebrities. So if you pretend that you are one by putting your face on a t-shirt like the analytical mastermind, maybe that shark will think twice about destroying and killing one of our nation's treasures, which is what I'm calling myself. I'm calling
right. I totally agree.
We are a national treasure. So pick all of these up, fgbt.com/merch, where you get all your stuff right there on that website. But I want to talk about, if you have one of these shirts, you have one of our items, it's like winning the lottery. We discussed that on our episode about Willy Wonka, which you should check out. But I found some interesting statistics here, guys. I want to see if you can work with them. I'll put a link to this on the website so people don't think I'm making this up. But the University of Zurich did some work on the fossils of megalodons, and they ran some simulations. Basically, how long could the megalodon survive given what we know? And they ran 10,000 of these simulations. In six out of the 10,000, they said that there's a 1% chance that the megalodon is alive today. Now, I don't really know what those numbers mean, but I know this, it's not zero. And in the great words of Lloyd Christmas, so you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah.
Could they be possible?
You know, we already talked about how there could be a chance, Dan, and it's nice to have science back us up with real simulations and real numbers. It doesn't actually surprise me from a couple things. I mean, first, the ocean is huge, right? And sharks, I think, can be solitary, right? Relatively speaking, creatures. I mean, obviously, you need more than one to keep them going, but you know, they don't live necessarily in huge packs. They don't have to. They do need to eat a fair amount, as Ben said. But you know,
I thought you said a feral lot, and I was like, that kind of works too.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. So I think the challenge for the sharks, the megalodons, was really the changes in temperature. And the changing in the hunting grounds, but obviously plenty of smaller sharks survived that. So I like these numbers, Dan. I am not going to bet on them because I don't bet. But you know, it is scary, but not inconceivable that you might run into a megalodon. So I think you're just got even more nervous of the ocean, Dan.
Well, the deep ocean for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it does seem somewhat unrealistic because, you know, when you're talking about these animals that go through thousands of teeth in their lifetime, we'd probably still be finding non-fossilized megalodon teeth. And we'd probably be finding chomped whales, you know, which we're not seeing. But, you know, maybe the problem is humans. Maybe there were megalodons, say, like 500, 600, 700 years ago before the whaling started. And we killed all of their food. And then they went extinct a little bit later than that. So maybe we just missed them.
That's what I was saying. I think we just missed them. And I don't know about you, but I am wiping my brow on that one. But if you think these numbers are, you know, if you think these numbers are right or wrong, let us know, of course. But let's get to our errors, additions, and omissions section first. Things we wanted to talk about, but we didn't quite get to. Denon, are there anything about sharks, rotating teeth, or a gigantic squid that you wanted to discuss?
So, Dan, I love this movie. I love the fun of quick deaths in disaster films. I think my favorite part, it's an addition, not an error. Woman on the phone, she says there's no way the shark's getting through the glass. And the shark immediately comes through the glass and asks, and you know, just eats her. Foreshadowing, instant death, no tension. I love it. Great movie moment. I think that was a mic drop moment, and I would just stick with that.
The mic drop. Mic is mic dropping, which I think is very important. What about you, Ben? Is there anything about, the conveyor belt teeth or people dying needlessly that you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know about people dying needlessly, but the other thing is the hubris of man. You know, we see them say only two sharks made it through. How do they know? How do they know only two made it through? They didn't have a camera. You know, for all we know, there's hundreds of megalodons now all over the ocean. Very irresponsible shepherding of the sea here, and very bad assumptions. You know, maybe these people deserve to get chomped.
I would completely agree with that. And I don't really have anything here. I just want to toot my own horn for watching both of these movies, given my tremendous fears on the edge of my seat watching these. Because there are some very scary scenes where in the dark depths of the ocean, you just see this face slowly come into frame behind a swimmer. And that is just terrifying to me. But if you want to share your fears, please do. Yeah, there's a easy place to do that, and that is you can get in touch with us on social media. You can find us on X, formerly Twitter, at FGGBTPod. We are on Facebook at FGGBT, and the website is FGGBT.com. But you can get in touch with us individually. Denon, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on most major social media. You just flip my name. It's at Denon Michael. That also happens to be my website, denonmichael.com. If you're looking for me on Facebook, if you're of that generation, you do have to stick a prof in there. It's Prof Denon Michael. If you're looking for me on YouTube, I'm old enough and had been on YouTube long enough, I snagged Michael Denon. So that's Michael Denon. And that's where you can find the fun Physics of X videos, where X is everything except politics. It's not formerly Twitter.
Right. Well, I do love that if you are of that generation for Facebook, because that might be all of us, I think. They're only the very young don't remember that. And that is not us, but you, Ben, where can people find you if they want to predict how old you are and whether you know what Facebook is?
Well, they can find me on all the major social media networks at B Seepser.
How do you spell that?
Spell that B-S-I-E-P-S-E-R.
And I can be found on X, formerly, are we just calling it X? I don't know. This is stupid. But X, formerly Twitter, at Daniel J. Glenn, on Instagram, at the Daniel J. Glenn, on Facebook, if you are aware of that. If that's not a fossil, if that hasn't gone extinct like the Megalodon, I'm at Analytical Mastermind. And my website is DanielJGlenn.com.
And if you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe.
And if you're watching us on YouTube, hit the like button, subscribe, and ring that bell so you never miss an episode.
And finally, this show contains powerful information that can be misused by those hell-bent on world domination, whether it's by disaster, sci-fi, or even horror. So take all the information we've given you and do good with it. Remember, when given the choice, always be a superhero, never a supervillain. So until next time, thank you for listening. Fascinating Gadgets, Gizmos, and Gear-Based Technologies is a Glencoe production and is produced by me, Daniel J. Glenn. The Fascinating Gadgets, Gizmos, and Gear-Based Technologies introduction was produced by Daniel J. Glenn and Paul Springers, with music and sound design written and performed by Paul Springers. Now, of course, if you're listening to this episode and you've gotten this far, you're going to want to subscribe. Well, how do you do that? We're on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. But if you're not already subscribed to those platforms, I made it easy for you. Go to our website, fggbt.com. You'll find links to those subscribe buttons and also links to our social media, both for the show and for our individual experts, the members of the Brain Trust. That's all right there. fggbt.com. And before you leave, don't forget to check out our other episodes. You can find the link at the top of the page for everything we've got, and you'll notice that we've got both a YouTube version and an audio-only version. Depending on what you like, we got it for you. And if you do like those videos, you can go ahead and subscribe to those as well. We're on youtube.com/DanielJGlenn. And once again, if you like this show, you're going to like everything that I do. Go to DanielJGlenn.com to find out more. Thank you for listening.